Welcome to the third in a series of interviews on disinformation and the threat it poses to democracy in the EU. This series is produced by Europe Direct Blanchardstown Library, part of the Fingal Network of Libraries. In this third interview, I spoke to Aoife Gallagher from the Institute of Strategic Dialogue about conspiracy theories, how they start, how people get taken in by them, and the harm they can do. Aoife Gallagher, you're very welcome, and thank you for agreeing to speak to me here at Europe Direct Blanchardstown.
No problem, Barry. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. And I just want to start off by getting a little bit of an idea of what you do and where you're coming from. So you're with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Could you tell me a little bit about what that is and what your role is within it?
Yeah, so ISD is a London-based think tank, and they deal with the issues around polarization and extremism and disinformation on a global scale. And they kind of run a wide range of programs, to be honest, like from kind of research-based analysis, which is what I'm involved in, to running education programs around online literacy or media literacy, and then kind of building networks of people and organizations from around the world who are also interested in kind of tackling these problems. And then there's kind of another, you know, section as well that kind of look at policy-based solutions to tackling these issues as well. So as I say, I'm a research analyst. Most of my work involves kind of looking at the intersection of conspiracy theories and far-right extremism in an online context and kind of where they intersect.
That's really interesting, because the last few interviews in this series, we've been talking about what are the solutions. And it's a really complex issue, because you're trying to balance free speech with regulation. And it's not always obvious, but we'll get back to that later. In the meantime, I'd just like to ask you, you mentioned that your area of work concerns conspiracy theories. And we've seen a lot of these in recent years, a real increase, whether it be politics, COVID, vaccines. The first thing I want to do is, how do we actually define a conspiracy theory?
Yeah, okay. So a conspiracy theory is essentially an attempt to explain certain events or certain phenomena by implying that a small group of powerful people are acting in secret for their own benefit and against the common good. And often these group of people are often portrayed as having, you know, the ultimate control over world events as well. I try and differentiate between conspiracy theories and conspiracies, because they are very, very different. You know, conspiracy theories tend to use a mixture of speculation and illogical reasoning and false information, and then the brain's kind of natural ability to detect patterns even when they don't exist. Conspiracies, on the other hand, those that have been proven to be true are proven to be true because of solid evidence that points to some sort of sinister collusion. So I'm not saying that, like, you know, bad people don't collude to do bad things every day. That happens all the time, you know. But conspiracy theories, and especially the ones that we see nowadays, they play on people's distrust, and they play on people's distrust in, you know, institutions like the media and the government, in order to kind of try and imply that no one involved in these institutions should be trusted. So it's kind of promoting this blanket distrust more than anything. And the kind of example that I'll give of a conspiracy, and one that has been proven to be true, and one of the big ones really of the modern age, is the fact that fossil fuel companies covered up and downplayed the effects of climate change for years. And there's documents, there's evidence to back that up. It's been proven. Do you know what I mean? So that's not a conspiracy theory, that's a conspiracy.
So that's really interesting, yeah, to make that difference between the conspiracy, which may well have through to it, and the conspiracy theory. And you spoke that you look at conspiracy theories kind of globally. And I think when we think of conspiracy theories and we think of disinformation, it's impossible not to think of the United States at the moment in particular. And there's this movement called QAnon that keeps coming up in the media. And I think a lot of people are confused of what it is. Just first, could you just tell me a little bit about what that is and how it came into being?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is a very complicated movement. It's kind of hard to explain in a short space of time, but I'll give it a go. So QAnon, essentially, it started as a fringe conspiracy theory movement. The core belief of QAnon is that the world is actually being run by a small cabal, an evil cabal of people who are involved in child trafficking, who kidnap and sacrifice children, normally for evil and satanic reasons. And within QAnon, the savior is Donald Trump. And especially during his presidency, Donald Trump was kind of, you know, put forward within QAnon as the ultimate savior, the one who was secretly fighting to defeat this evil cabal. And the people involved in this cabal are, you know, people that are Donald Trump's enemies, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Democratic politicians, kind of generally, liberal celebrities, philanthropists like Bill Gates and George Soros and people like that. And the way it started with an anonymous person who called themselves Q, who was claiming to be a high-level government insider in the Department of Energy in the US. So this person started posting kind of cryptic and nonsensical clues on an anonymous message board online called 4chan. And this happened towards the end of 2017, just at the end of October of 2017. And 4chan, if anyone doesn't know it, I mean, 4chan is, I mean, it's an anonymous image board, number one. Everyone that posts there is anonymous. But it's really, in the past, you know, 10 years or so, it's become very, very much associated with the alt-right and white supremacist movements.
And no real moderation, is there, on it as such?
There, shockingly, there actually is moderation on 4chan, but very little.
Okay.
There is a very, very high bar for the things that are allowed to post, essentially. And essentially, yeah, what QAnon did was that, you know, Q would post these drops, they're called Q drops on 4chan, and the people that followed Q, who were known as Anons, which is where Q Anon came from, they would then decode and kind of try and interpret these nonsensical clues. And they would come up with kind of wild and illogical kind of ways to explain geopolitics and make predictions about Trump's plans to defeat this evil cabal. But really, I mean, QAnon has changed so much over the past 4 years. It really has just evolved into something completely different. And it's kind of become a different beast, really, than just the Q and the posts and the kind of decoding of it. It really has become, I describe it now as a digital cult in a lot of ways. I
don't think it's a
conspiracy theory movement anymore. And what it really has become is, I think it's become a blueprint for kind of the wider conspiratorial movement, and especially because of the pandemic. QAnon has this ability to ingest every other conspiracy theory that's kind of ever been known. And during the pandemic, it ingested, you know, anti-vaccine and kind of vaccine trutherism and all the COVID denial kind of stuff. And it really, it also, of course, famously was involved in spreading the voter fraud conspiracies that were the catalyst for the storming of the Capitol at the start of the year. So really, QAnon is just, people often describe it as the blob or as the conspiracy theory that's eaten up every other conspiracy theory.
Okay, and I mean, we obviously think of QAnon as something from the so-called alt-right, as it's known. Are there any left-wing equivalents in the conspiracy theory world? Is there?
Like, there aren't. I mean, QAnon is a very, very unique phenomenon, and it is very intrinsically tied to the far right. Now, that's not to say that, you know, left, people in the left don't believe in conspiracy theories. They certainly do. And if there's one thing that we've actually seen over the past couple of years is that the likes of QAnon and the likes of the kind of COVID conspiracy theories are pulling people in on every side of the political spectrum. Doesn't matter if you're right or left. They have a way to pull people in no matter what. And especially QAnon was able to make its way into the kind of new age health and wellness kind of communities.
Wow, okay.
Or yoga communities. You know, these kind of movements that, you know, a couple of years ago I would have been like, ah, no, they're not going to fall for things like this. So it really just shows the power of conspiracy theories, really, to kind of pull people in no matter kind of their political affiliations.
Yeah, it seems like you sometimes you see otherwise quite intelligent, well-educated people getting pulled in. And we'll maybe talk about the reasons for that a little bit later. But I mean, obviously, we've spoken about the American context there, and that's probably one of the best known ones in the media. But is there any kind of similar conspiracy theories, maybe not on the scale of QAnon, but are we beginning to see anything in Ireland, in the EU in general? Is this something we have to be careful of here too?
I mean, definitely. We definitely have to be careful of it. This is a worldwide thing and it's happening worldwide. And I suppose if you kind of want to talk, you know, it's very easy to kind of relate everything to the COVID conspiracy theories, but we'll kind of, you know, pull back from that. And I think the one that comes to mind in a kind of European context is one called the Great Replacement. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. So, yeah, I mean, this is a conspiracy theory that is an inherently white nationalist conspiracy theory first, I think, is what people need to know. But it originated in France in kind of the mid-2000s. And it essentially claims that governments are colluding to purposefully replace their white native European populations with migrants. And as I say, it's a core kind of belief of white nationalist movements worldwide. And it tends to, you know, do all the things that white nationalist movements do. It demonizes migrants. and refugees. It misinterprets and exaggerates immigration statistics. And it's also become, you know, a justification for a number of the biggest mass shootings that we've seen throughout the world over the past number of years. And probably the one that would come to mind is the Christchurch mosque shooting in 2019. But also, you know, a number of ones in the States, the El Paso shooting in Texas in 2019.
There's been numerous, yeah.
Yeah, I could go on, to be honest. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is something that's been seized upon internationally by far-right activists, but very much in Ireland as well. And they definitely certainly use this. I mean, certain activists and political parties here have been known to promote the great replacement theory as well. Yeah.
So this is like, we sometimes have a tendency to be a bit complacent maybe in this country and think, oh, that's something that happens elsewhere, it's far away. But we've seen in our other discussions in this series, there's far right movements in Hungary and Poland, but also in Italy and France and Germany. You know, it's something to be wary of, the Netherlands too. Obviously, the last 18 months or so have been very difficult for everyone with the COVID-19 pandemic. And we've seen a real rise in these conspiracy theory movements, you know, about the virus itself, about the vaccines. And what is the reason for the rise? Why do the conspiracy theories rise at this time? Is it a way of explaining this? Is it comforting to people, maybe?
Yeah, kind of both those things, to be honest. I mean, I think COVID has really kind of provided the ultimate catalyst for conspiracy theories. And, you know, it's a mixture of things, right? So, I mean, conspiracy theories do always tend to arise from shocking world events. If you think about 9/11, I mean, a famous one that many conspiracy theories came from, the assassination of JFK, the moon landing, do you know what I mean? So these, like, conspiracy theories have always kind of come out of things like this. So I think the fact that there are conspiracy theories around is pretty normal, to be honest. But the real kind of unique element of what's, you know, of this time, I suppose, in history, is the way the internet has really kind of functioned to spread these. And the way I kind of try and explain it is that before the pandemic, there were certain groups of kind of conspiratorial communities online, but they kind of stayed in their own kind of little pockets. So you had the anti-5G movement, you had the anti-vaccine movement, you had the kind of far-right movements, that, and, you know, and QAnon and things like that. And essentially when the pandemic struck, you know, we always kind of try and describe it as kind of this big Venn diagram. So like all these movements have kind of different beliefs, but they kind of all overlap as well. And they overlap in their massive distrust really of governments and institutions. And so they all kind of came together when COVID struck because they believed that there was something more sinister going on. And essentially what happened was that the online ecosystem where these movements lived, it just absolutely exploded. And, you know, during the lockdowns and even now today, I mean, people are still searching for answers as to why all this is going on. And I still think that a year and a half into it, we're still, you know, we might be a bit immune to how crazy things have gotten, but we're still looking for answers. And social media platforms are very, very good at targeting people with content that is shocking, that keeps their eyes on screens. And conspiracy theories do that very, very well. So I think the accessibility of them online is definitely a reason why they've exploded. But as you said as well, they do give people a sense of control. They give people the idea that they know what's going on, that they have the answers. And that is actually somewhat comforting to people to kind of think, no, I have this information and I actually know what's going on.
Yeah, and I'll direct people to look at the first interview in this series with Ricardo da Silva, and he goes into quite a lot of detail about the social media platforms and how they put this content in front of people's eyes, and the, you know, how the algorithms work, for example, and advertising, and how it all kind of comes together in a perfect storm. But you were talking there about it being kind of comforting for people. I suppose it can be very difficult when something like a pandemic happens. It's a horrible feeling that we have no control over it. And I suppose to latch on to a conspiracy field, we have some control. We know where it comes from. So I want to ask you now a little bit about the psychology of conspiracy theories. I mean, just before we kind of went live here, I mentioned I watched a documentary about the flat earthers. And the people involved were so emotionally invested in the seeming innocuous theory. Why is it that people get taken in by these movements, and why are they so emotionally invested in them?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of psychological kind of reasons why people do get into these movements. And I will say that everyone is susceptible to these movements and everyone is susceptible to disinformation. To think that you're like above being fooled by them is actually a big mistake to make, because the reason that people fall into it is actually kind of built into our brains. Like one of the big things is pattern perception. I think I mentioned this earlier. Humans have this ability to detect patterns. We do it all the time. It's kind of, you know, it's very much built into our brains, but we also have an ability to see patterns where they don't exist. And an example that I'll give of this is you'll look at the clouds and you'll automatically see shapes in the clouds. You know, those shapes are not there. It's just your brain kind of making that happen. But with conspiracy theories, it makes it easy for people to see a load of coincidences and to deduce some kind of a meaning or a pattern from them. And it makes them think that they're not coincidences, that they're actually all linked. And, you know, you were talking about the flat earthers. I actually went back over the past couple of weeks for the time that's in it, and I've been watching a number of the 9/11 conspiracy theory films that came out kind of a number of years afterwards. And what they tend to do is they tend to bombard you with a whole lot of information that creates this kind of false pattern for the viewer. When I was watching them, I was actually watching them from a research perspective, and I'm actually trying to kind of break down every single thing they say. I had to pause every 15 to 20 seconds, I would say, because that is the amount of information that they're giving you. And, you know, no one's going to, a regular viewer isn't going to stop and fact check every single thing that's been thrown at them. And a lot of them are all based on coincidences and speculation, but they just have this way of really kind of worming into your brain to make you think that things are not as they appear. So that's a big part of it. The other kind of major thing is that they play on people's confirmation biases. So people will more easily accept information that fits in with their view of the world and for what they already believe. So if you take COVID, for example, you know, say if you're someone that before the pandemic, you didn't trust the media. A lot of people don't trust the media. It's a common feeling, right? Maybe you were failed by the healthcare system, and you also don't trust the government. You know, I mean, they're kind of normal things. I think a lot of people feel all those to a certain extent. And then you're thrown into the middle of a pandemic, a very, very scary, you know, crazy situation. And maybe at some point you're presented with this theory that all these entities that you don't trust are secretly colluding to destroy your life, right? And these are, they're very compelling. You know, I'm kind of simplifying it a little bit, but the way that they're really like put forward online, they're very, very compelling, and they're very easy to buy into. So they kind of use this mixture of speculation and false information and illogical reasoning to take people's kind of natural distrust and to just take it to a completely different level. And then the other thing as well is that, and we see this happening more and more now, and especially because of the internet, but belief in one conspiracy theory tends to mean that you're going to believe in more than one. So they do have this kind of snowballing effect. So you might, and again, that's because, you know, the enemies are often the same. It's often about, you know, distrusting everything that the government and the media says. So if you kind of believe that everything that the media and the government are telling you are lies, you're going to buy into a whole lot of, you know, other conspiracy theories as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm getting is that these conspiracies seem to almost prey on people's often legitimate distrust. I mean, if a newspaper is caught with a false story, we'll say, well, that's it then, you know, I'm right. Or if a government of a country is caught doing something they shouldn't be doing, that will confirm. So, yeah, I can see how you can get there. But I want to talk about the actual origins of these theories. I mean, in general, do these theories get started by people who genuinely believe them? Or is there more sinister origins? Are there maybe groups or people who put these out, or governments even, who have an agenda? Or maybe is it a mixture of both?
It's definitely a mixture of both. You know, people like me will use the terms misinformation and disinformation. And I mean, I admittedly use them interchangeably, but they do have very different meanings. Yes. So misinformation is when people spread false information, but they are not aware that the information that they're spreading is false. Disinformation, on the other hand, is when people spread false information and they know that the information they're spreading is false. There is an intent there to deceive. So really, this whole phenomenon happens when the two of these mix together. If you take something like QAnon, I've done like work into the early days of QAnon, and you find that the people that were spreading it at the very start, a lot of them were true believers. They were people that believed what they were being told and they felt a duty to spread it. And then there are the bad actors, that you know, what we would call bad actors, the people who use the power of these movements to further their own agenda, even if they don't believe the things that they're spreading themselves. And this happens all the time. This is kind of how the COVID conspiracy movements work as well. There are certainly people within those movements who I mean, I believe know what they're saying is false, and I know that that they have to be spreading this information for some kind of other agenda. So really, there's both, there's a lot of victims within these movements. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of people that are spreading this information, and they truly believe that what they're spreading is true. And then yeah, there's the people that are kind of, fooling people essentially.
So, I mean, it does look like there's a mix, and some things may start as a deliberate disinformation campaign, and then people unwittingly continue it as misinformation. They believe what they're seeing is true. They're spreading it on. Sometimes it could be quite innocent even.
Yeah, exactly. The Lewis is free,
Yes, I've seen that one. Yeah. Just let me tell everyone the Lewis is not free. We don't want to get into trouble about that. And I mean, we spoke about some of the reasons for this, the psychology behind it, but in some of the, in particular the alt-right conspiracy theories, there seems to be a strong undercurrent of racism there. And you've mentioned migrants already. Is that something you found to be the case?
Yes, and when you look into a lot of conspiracy theories, they tend to, I kind of discussed this narrative before, the kind of idea that there's a small shadowy group of people that are pulling the strings in the background, and that they have this kind of ultimate control over the world. And when you look into this narrative can actually be traced back to a pretty famous piece of propaganda that was circulated in the early 1900s, and it was called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, at the time, it was found to be fake. It was found to be massively plagiarized, but that didn't stop it from spreading, which should be a lesson, I think, for all of us. This was well before the internet, and this thing spread pretty widely. But what it purported to be were the minutes of a meeting that took place between Jewish elders, where they discussed their plans for world domination, where they said they were going to take over the monetary system and the media system, and ultimately, again, this played into people's confirmation biases. They didn't care that it wasn't true. It just played into their confirmation biases about what they felt about Jewish people. And it ultimately went on to form the basis for the crimes of the Holocaust. And what you actually find is that that narrative, that kind of small, shadowy group of people, that has just been recycled over the ages. If you look at something like the Illuminati or the Freemasons or the New World Order or QAnon, they're all kind of taking this narrative
Okay.
and kind of just giving it a new coat of paint. Now, it means that the anti-Semitism is hidden below the surface. It's not that, everyone that believes in the Illuminati is an anti-Semite. Do you know what I mean? But the danger really is that it's only a short leap really to anti-Semitism from there. And then, the other thing is with QAnon as well. One of the main, ideas about QAnon is that these evil people torture children and extract a substance called adrenochrome from children, right? This is like one of the ideas of QAnon. And this is actually, again, a recycled anti-Semitic conspiracy theory known as blood libel, which used to claim that Jewish people would kidnap Christian children and drink their blood. You know what I mean? So they're kind of tried and tested methods. They've been used for decades, if not centuries, really, to kind of pull people in.
So a lot of these are, it's nothing new really, and anti-Semitism has been around for, I mean, centuries, if not millennia, in Europe. And I think of in France we had the Dreyfus affair, which was a total fabrication, and it obviously fed into people's anti-Semitic feeling at the time. So this isn't anything new, but I suppose now with the internet, this stuff can spread wildly, and it spread in France over 100 years ago without the internet. So we can only imagine now what can happen. And I want to, again, we've spoken a bit about America, so I want to kind of focus on Europe again. Do these conspiracy theories, do you think, pose a genuine threat to democracy at a say, local, national, and EU level?
Yes, I mean the easy answer there is yes, they certainly do. What a lot of these conspiracy theories do, and especially the ones that are kind of pushed by the far right, I mean the far right kind of in general, they want to destroy liberal democracies, right? And they do this by destroying people's trust in the foundations of democracy. And I suppose, I mean, the US is a good example to use. Do you know what I mean? The way that conspiracy theories were able to just destroy people's trust in their electoral system in the US, and that's something that I don't know how that's ever going to be solved. There are recall elections going on in California, I think today or tomorrow, and already the conversation that's going on there is that the vote is rigged. There's voter fraud going around. So I think that people should not underestimate the way that these movements can spread. I think every country in the world should be aware of the potential damage that these movements can do. And at the moment, there's very little way to control it. And all it takes is one really compelling narrative to pull people in. So, I mean, obviously this is my job, but I really do think that it's one of the main things that we need to be looking out for at this stage. And I think any government that says that they're immune to it are fooling themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And then, like I said, there are movements in Europe. I mean, as we've mentioned, Poland and Hungary have come up several times in the conversations we have. But there's a strong far-right movement in France, in Italy, in the Netherlands, you know, and I think we'd be foolish to be complacent on this side of the Atlantic. Exactly. And what happens in America tends to come here too, culturally. And I've already heard some of the language that's been used in America around fraud and that same language being used here by certain groups.
Yeah, they very much pull like ideas and tactics and strategies from kind of US movements. I mean, I think, you know, earlier in the year when that anti-lockdown protest got violent at the top of Grafton Street, there was this immediate sense within these communities to blame Antifa for the violence. And that's exactly what happened in the States on January 6th as well. It was, oh, they're not Trump supporters, they're Antifa. Do you know what I mean? And it's kind of mind blowing, really, to kind of see how, you know, those kind of narratives can just, you know, spread so easily, and people just kind of buy into them in the exact same way.
And often it's just even about sowing a seed of doubt. You put this stuff out, just make people doubt. It can be enough to kind of weaken confidence in the democratic system. Even if there's no truth to it, just sow a little bit of doubt there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to move on, I mean, you mentioned there with the violence in Grafton Street, and we saw violence in America the 6th of January. But on a more personal level, can these theories cause harm to people?
I mean, yes. I mean, the people that believe in them, and, you know, these stories are becoming more and more frequent. You hear stories of people on their deathbeds who decided not to get the vaccine because they believed in the conspiracy theories about the vaccine, and they've subsequently passed away from COVID. They're devastating. It doesn't matter. I mean, people online tend to kind of, you know, laugh at these people that have died because they didn't get the vaccine. I think that's disgusting, to be honest. I don't know why anyone would think that's a good thing to do. So that's definitely one of the kind of, you know, short-term effects that we're probably seeing right now. You know, not vaccinating children against preventable childhood diseases. This was something that was happening before the pandemic, but I do think that it's probably something that's going to increase afterwards. I've seen conversations online where people are kind of unwilling to take their children to the hospital or doctors when they're sick because they no longer trust the health system. That's pretty scary. And, you know, that could have serious, serious, devastating repercussions for people. There are a lot of people within these movements that are talking about taking their children out of school and homeschooling them because they don't trust the education system anymore. And again, I mean, there's nothing wrong with homeschooling your children, but if you're going to homeschool them to believe in conspiracy theories, that's an issue, you know? And then I would say, the one, like the kind of overarching one that tends to come up all the time is the real dissociative effect that it has on people. It tends to pull people away from their friends and family members. Yes. It can be very, very hard, if not impossible sometimes, to change people's minds when they get into these theories. And, you know, because we're living in the middle of a pandemic, the decisions that people are making off the back of their beliefs, they can really have an impact on the health and well-being of people around them. So there are a lot of stories of people just being cut off from their nearest and dearest because of these beliefs. And this can drive people further into isolation. It can drive people into further extremist movements. So, I mean, there are a lot of consequences to that. And that's just kind of on a personal kind of a one-to-one level. I mean, we can talk about the violence as well that they can cause for people that actually truly believe these movements as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen cases of you know, friendships ending or families becoming estranged over the pandemic, over arguments. To do with this, or I watched a documentary about a lady whose father started listening to far right radio as he was driving to work, and gradually became brainwashed, really. And initially, he actually kind of pulled back from it eventually. But, you know, families have broken apart over this.
Yeah. Essentially, it's very, very sad. It really is, and you kind of see within these communities in Ireland, I mean, you see people encouraging each other to cut off ties, you know what I mean? And, you know, that's the thing. It's kind of
very cult-like behavior, isn't it?
It is in a lot of ways. Yeah. And that's why I kind of do describe some of these movements as cults, because they do kind of encourage, I mean, it's a different kind of cult than what you'd be used to, because normally cults have some kind of a leader, but like these movements don't necessarily have leaders. They're kind of almost like a self-radicalizing kind of a movement. Yeah.
I've asked all the other contributors the same question here. What do you think needs to be done to counter these conspiracy theory movements? And are we talking about regulating social media, looking at algorithms, or education, or anything else?
All of the above, I think. Okay. Like, I do think that, you know, in the short term, kind of the best defense that we can mount against this is to prevent people from getting into these movements. And I do think that a lot of that prevention comes in the form of education. I think that we need to kind of, you know, educate people on the way social media algorithms work, for example, making people aware that what pops up on their screens can be very unreliable. It can often be dangerous. Instilling in people that if you want to know what's happening in the world, you need to get your news and your information from reliable sources. Kind of, you know, giving people the tools to be able to fact check the things that they're seeing online, and to kind of, you know, realize why they probably shouldn't believe the kind of ramblings of unqualified people online. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Media Literacy Ireland do great work on this, on kind of trying to promote this kind of, you know, self fact-checking kind of idea, I suppose. And then long term, I mean, there does have to be serious discussions had on ways to kind of rein in the social media platforms that host this content. Their algorithms are, in a lot of ways, they're a black hole to researchers. You know, a lot of people really don't truly know how they work. I think there's no doubt, to be honest, that the way they function, the way they kind of pull in data from people's online habits, it has to be an invasion of privacy. I feel like it's an invasion of privacy, and I feel like we're all kind of trapped in, we have to use these devices now and we have to use all these apps, but they're also like tracking our every move. Do you know what I mean? So I think there needs to be some serious conversations had about regulating those platforms, and, you know, trying to figure out the kind of technology that we can employ to kind of, you know, build solutions, I suppose, instead. And then I suppose the other thing is investment in reliable media and really good journalism, because I think the only way to counter a lot of bad information is with a whole lot of good information. So instilling trust in very good journalism is also key, I think.
And I'm glad you mentioned Media Literacy Ireland, because two of our other interviews were with Eileen Cullity and Ricardo De Silva from Media Literacy Ireland, who spoke in detail about social media and the EU's response, the EU code on media platforms and how that will work. And I think in libraries, Ricardo was very adamant that we should have a role too in helping people with information literacy and media literacy. And it may be something, as we're able to welcome people back, hopefully in the not too distant future, we might look at doing as a future event. Absolutely. And so just to finish up, I want to ask you, what tips would you give people to maybe avoid falling into these conspiracy theories? And what's the best way to deal with, say, family members and friends who have, and you may feel concerned for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think to avoid falling into them, the best piece of advice, and I've mentioned this, is to get your news from reliable sources, right? Read 2, 3, or 4 different media publications to get a range of views. I'm not saying that you should only get your media from 1 or 2 places. You know what I mean? Kind of read across the spectrum of news to find out what's happening, and check your sources. If something seems far-fetched and unbelievable, there's a strong possibility that it's not true. I think it's about developing a healthy level of skepticism that doesn't turn into cynicism, because we should still be skeptical of what the media says, and we should be skeptical of what our politicians say. But it's about not going down so far that you don't trust anything that anyone says in those institutions. That's really the point that kind of gets to a danger level, I think. And then I suppose to, like, when it comes to talking to people, this is a hard question to answer, to be honest. And the one piece of advice that I'll normally give is to just make sure you keep the lines of communication open. I think if you think that someone's kind of fallen into these movements, you know, as I say, it can be very hard to actually discuss the details of what they believe. It can be very hard to kind of form an argument with them, because a lot of the time kind of facts and, you know, rational arguments don't really work, because they're kind of, a lot of the time, they're based on emotions. So even if you do find that you can't talk to someone about COVID or about the political subjects that they're kind of into anymore, I think just make sure that they don't get cut off from reality. Just, you know, make sure that they kind of have an outlet there, that they can still kind of have that base to reality if they want. And if you do kind of want to talk to them more specifically about their beliefs, approach them with empathy. I think that is really the one thing, because I mean, it's very easy to call people stupid and call people crazy and all the rest that fall into these movements. But as I say, they are victims for the most part. And what you'll often find, you often find that people have a lot of the same fears and have a lot of the same trust issues. So I think kind of finding what that core distrust is or that core fear is and kind of going from there, because, you know, that there does need to be a sense of, yeah, kind of empathy and just understanding really that this could happen to anyone.
I think in these, like, confrontation doesn't really work. As you said, a lot of these beliefs are not based on logic or information. They're based on emotion. And also to go back to what you were saying about getting your information from multiple sources, that's a point Maria Walsh, MEP, made to me when we spoke earlier. That'll be the second interview in this series. And she's very careful to get different points of view, including ones that clash with her own beliefs. And it's important, even if you don't end up believing that point of view, but at least you understand where it's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much for that, Aoife Gallagher. That was really very interesting. So thank you very much for joining me.
No problem at all.